Well, welcome. My name is Susan, and I'm a longtime Buddhist practitioner and a teacher, and also a healthcare chaplain. And this is Jim Mimot. Jim, did you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm really happy to welcome all of you here today. The last time I was here teaching this program, which I've done a couple of times before, was in March of 2020, and we were covering Right Effort. By April, we had had to close down the entire center. So it's been kind of my goal, important goal to me, to bring this program back to the center so that we can come back together here. And so it's a realization of the dream, and I'm glad you want to participate in that dream. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah. So here we are. So happy to be practicing with you today and talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, the path to freedom, and the Buddha's path to freedom. And, you know, I want to say something about the freedom that we talk about in Buddhist practice and thought. You know, in our culture, freedom usually means, oh, I should be able to stay and do just what I want. And, you know, we see the results every day of that. But, you know, when we talk about freedom and the path, we're talking about freedom from suffering. And, you know, we have today, we'll be talking about the Four Noble Truths. The Noble Eightfold Path is the fourth Noble Truth. So I thought I would just briefly get on to those. And Jim will be talking more in depth after we sit together. And just a few logistics. The bathroom is through there, in case you're not familiar. And there are some listening devices, I believe, if you're having trouble.
Right over there on that table.
They're right over there.
Yeah.
Thank you, Maria. So getting back to the Four Noble Truths, the foundational teachings in Buddhism, and the very first teachings that the Buddha gave after his enlightenment, he went to seek out his old companions and friends who were still doing their ascetic practices. And so they were the first to receive his teaching. So freedom from suffering. So the first noble truth is just to acknowledge that there is suffering, right? We all have these bodies that get sick, and you know, we have loved ones who leave us or pass away. We have aging, and you know, we have a lot of challenges that are hard for us as human beings. We suffer. The second noble truth is the Buddha's identifying the cause of the suffering. The cause of the suffering is our basically wishing things were other than what they are, wishing we could have and hold on to the things that we like and get rid of, and never ever have to deal with the things that we don't like. This is the root of suffering as defined by the Buddha, and I don't think we would argue with that. The third noble truth is that the good news that there is a way out of this human conditions, this suffering. And then the Buddha goes on to illuminate the Noble Eightfold Path, the path to happiness, to the end of suffering. And during the course of the next 8 months, we'll be covering each one of those steps on the path. There are the the sila or the ethics steps on the path for so that we can be skillful and right living, less suffering with when we're paying attention and not cheating and lying and all those things that cause suffering not only for ourselves and for others. And there is the wisdom part of the path, this wise view, which we'll talk about, and wise intention and thought that follows along from that view. So, and this is obviously, well, maybe not so obvious if you're new. How many people are new to this practice? Okay, and how many people have been practicing just for a year or so? Then longer, the rest of you have longer practice. Okay, wonderful. Okay, so this is, this path is an inward focus. The path to freedom, the path to the end of suffering is not out there. You know, we're not seeking our true happiness out in the world where everything is changing. We know it's, everything is changing right down to the cellular level in our bodies. You know, with that in mind, the inconstant and unsatisfactory nature of all of our experience. And when we're mindful and pay attention, we really see the truth of this. So we understand that it's not out there. So this path develops our inward resources and our inward capacity, for a true happiness that doesn't rely on having the conditions out there just the way we like them. And as you will find, or maybe already know, that this practice and these teachings encompass both our minds and our hearts. Very heartfelt practice that we do. So today we'll be talking about these four, the three noble truths, and the fourth noble truth, of course, next month will be the first step on the path, wise view, right view. So I wonder if we can take some time for to just go around and just say our names so that we kind of hopefully, we're hoping, Jim and I are hoping, that we'll see you every month for every step of the path. We hope that you'll make that commitment. And so it might be good to know who we are, if you wouldn't mind. I'm Susan. And maybe just say your name.
I'm Stefan.
Stefan. Welcome, Stefan.
I am Joey.
Joey.
Sydney.
Sorry?
Sydney.
Cindy.
No, Sydney.
Sydney.
Like Australia.
Sydney. Welcome, Sydney.
I'm Renee.
Renee, welcome.
Hi, I'm Astrid.
Astrid.
Adriana.
Adriana.
Melissa.
Say.
Melissa.
Oh, Melissa. Yes, Melissa. I remember you. Yes, from another April path. Yes. Welcome. And
we also need to pick up our people online.
I'm sorry?
We need to pick up the people online.
Oh, that,
as well.
Of course, yes. And I'm sorry, what was
Madeline?
Madeline. Welcome, Madeline. Okay, Maria. Yeah. And of course, and
I'm Maria.
And our manager, Maria. Thank you for being here to support us. Really appreciate it. Okay. And then people online, would you like to just say, we can see your name, but still good to hear your voice.
Hi, I'm Paula.
Welcome.
Thank you.
My name is Satya.
Satya and Lucinda.
Uh-huh. Yep. Hi, I'm Heidi.
Hi, Heidi.
Everyone, I'm Tara.
Sarah.
Tara.
Tara.
Tara. And Sharon.
Yes, hi, I'm Sharon. Glad to be here.
Hello. Okay, welcome.
Thank you. You're all. We welcome all you as well. You're an important part of our community.
Yes, yes. Okay, so
I have a quick question.
Oh, of course.
If I know that you said in the email that we should probably choose either online or in person, but in the event that I want to go to the facility, can I come maybe once or twice to the Insight Center?
Oh, of course. You're all the online people are welcome to come to the center here. You would prefer to sit in person. Of course.
Thank you.
You're all welcome. Yeah. I know sometimes it's hard to get here. Okay, so are there any questions before we'll sit together for about 15 minutes, and then Jim will talk more about the Noble Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. So are there any questions? Anyone? Okay, so let's sit together then. I'll do a little bit of guidance in the beginning, and then we'll sit in silence for about 15 minutes. So to begin, you might take a few kind of long breaths if that's comfortable for you. And as you breathe out, just feel yourself just settle in to your cushion, your seat here and now, the weight of your body on the cushion, the feeling of your feet on the floor, holding you here. And I like to start my sitting with a sense of goodwill, a sense of goodwill towards yourself. We do this practice as a very deep way of caring for ourselves. So wish yourself to be well and safe. And then you might bring your awareness to your body to see if there are any tight or tense areas after your efforts to come here, maybe a little bit of tension and stress in the body, maybe some tightness in the belly or the chest. Maybe you can breathe into those areas. The belly is a place where we often hold some tension, tightness. So if you can just relax the belly. Relax the shoulders, just let the arms just hang loose from the shoulder. And your hands relax and flowing over your thighs, or just held lightly relaxed in your lap. And if you're comfortable tuning in to your breathing, you might just notice, how is the breath here in this moment? However it is fine. We're just noticing. Maybe fast or slow. shallow or deep. However it is, it's fine. We're just aware. As we sit in this way, we can be open to the full flow of our human experience. Sound, physical sensations, thoughts and stories and coming into the mind. You can just let them flow on by. You don't need to get involved. We're just aware. Noticing the reactivity that might be present. Maybe wanting something to go away or wanting to hold on to something. Just noticing and then letting go. and are sitting together a few verses from the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. Let none deceive another, nor despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings.
So,
what's
on?
Wow. Maria, would you be willing to make the Donna announcement now before Jim starts his teaching?
Sure. Hey, everybody. I'm just here to tell you.
Here's the microphone. Oh. Maybe you should.
Yes,
use that so the people online will hear. Thank you.
I'm Maria, and I'm lucky to be on the board with Jim. And one of the things that we do as a board is we try to make sure that to financially steward our organization, both with finances and volunteer work. And I'm actually the chair of the volunteer committee. So those are two ways that you can be generous to your community. We never charge a penny for any of our events, but we do ask that you reach in and just think about what this, if you can give something and be generous with your heart, whatever is right for you. You can, I know a lot of people don't carry cash these days, so you can always go online and do it. And for the people on Zoom, you can go to our website and look up Donna, which is a Pali word for generosity, right? Is it generosity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I didn't want to misspeak. So thank you. And if you're interested in volunteering, you can also there's a volunteer connection on our website, and I'll get in touch with you and I'll tell you about different options and opportunities to meet people. And whatever works for you, but it feels good to be generous. And also, we, of course, want to keep things going here and be able to provide these services for another 30 years or so or more. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Yeah, okay, that's good. So today is technically an introductory session to the Eightfold program that we'll be following. And there, for me, there's really no better introduction than to go back a little bit and look at the first three Noble Truths. Because if you don't understand what is being talked about and said there, it doesn't. You can't really go into the full depth of each of the elements of the Eightfold Path, why they're there, and what you're trying to do. Now, a path obviously is meant to be a way that you follow, one that people have gone before you, and hopefully leads to a specific destination. And there are a number of paths in the Buddhist tradition. Buddhist folklore says there are about 84,000 different paths. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to go. But the Buddha knew, even at the time that he taught, that different people had to learn different ways.
So even when he went out to talk, if he went out to talk to the Brahmins, he used a language that they were familiar with. He used references to their historical texts. And if he went to talk to a group of farmers living in a rural town, he would completely switch to somewhat different topics, somewhat different language, somewhat different ways of speaking, because his goal was really to reach the people and teach them how to liberate themselves from dukkha, from this mind state that causes suffering. So he would switch. Now, the Eightfold Path is obviously, since it's only one of 84,000, or they say, is not the only path, but in our lineage, it's one of the most important paths. The Theravadan tradition has taken it as one of the central. The Eightfold Path and the path that's developed in the Satipatthana Sutta on mindfulness, foundations of mindfulness, tend to be the two that are most important to us. Part of the reason I think that this path is important to us is in our history of Buddhism, it's considered to be the Buddha's first teaching. In the Samyutta Nikaya, there is a sutta called, in English, called the Sitting in Motion of the Wheel of the Dharma, which tells the biographical history of the Buddha in a few months after his awakening. In the very, very first period after he awakened, he had to do a lot of soul searching about whether he wanted to teach, because he felt that what he had discovered was going to be so difficult to teach, went against the grain of society so much that it was going to be a unhappy and unfruitful endeavor if he did it. But one of the deities, one of the creator deities in the heavenly realm of the time, as the folklore says, and that was Shambhati, came to him and convinced him that in the world out there, there were people that if he were to go out and teach, that would be able to understand what he was saying and thereby come to this type of liberation. So he finally decides to do that. And when he goes out, he finds that most of the people he associated with, like his teachers who taught him jhanas and things like that, had passed away. So the five people he found closest that he felt he could take that first step of actually going out the first time and trying to teach, because, you know, that takes a certain amount of practice and everything else, even for a Buddha. But so he tracked them down to Deer Park and he gives them this talk. And the talk is on the Four Noble Truths. So that's why one of the reasons it's important in our tradition, being the first of the teachings that he ever gave. And it was actually in the course of that, one of the companions that he had worked with, Anakandana, actually attains Satipatthani, which is stream entry, the first stage of liberation. So the talk was, in fact, very effective. So this is a path, then, if you follow it, and others have already set it down for you, it's meant to take you to Satipatthani, to full liberation as its outcome. So it's important in that sense. Now, when it's normally taught, it's taught as four insights, and those are the four that have been mentioned. And that is, those insights are that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and the way to reach that end of suffering is this Eightfold Path. In a way, though, that's a modern simplification of what actually was taking place. There is a little bit of two problems that I see with this to some extent. And one, I think a lot of you may be familiar with, is that the word suffering that we choose to translate this with was chosen by people that had not yet gone deeply into the Buddhist teachings and begin to immerse themselves in what was being said. And as we've come to more modern times, and we actually do have a number of teachers and students and monastics that have gone into Asia and learned to read Pali and doing that, they have discovered that there are some problems with that definition of suffering, which is the reason that a lot of modern teachers start substituting other words. You know, they start substituting stress, dis-ease, discomfort, a number of other terms. Because the dukkha itself is much broader meaning than that. Other teachers simply keep it as dukkha. They don't translate it. They assume that as you practice and you start to deepen your understanding of the Buddhist path, that you will come to appreciate its much wider meaning without the baggage of all the connotations and meanings that we put on the word suffering, which are not going to be the quite, or any of the other words too. I mean, we put connotations on discomfort and so forth. None of those are going to be completely correct. So that's one problem. And to give you an idea of what some of the teachers who have looked at that have done, when going back to the etymology, Joseph Goldstein, who is a well-known teacher, explains the etymology of the word dukkha in the following way. The word dukkha is made up of the prefix du and the root ka. Du means bad or difficult. Ka means empty. Empty here can refer to several things, some specific, some more general. One of the specific meanings refers to the empty axle hole of a wheel. If the axle fits poorly into the center of the wheel or is misaligned, we're going to get a bumpy ride no matter how smooth the road we might be on. This is a good analogy for a ride through samsara. Another gentleman by the name of Sir Monier Williams, who was a British scholar who gave us our first Sanskrit dictionary in 1899, traces the roots to the Sanskrit term du, which means bad, the same thing, but sta, to stand. Analio concurs in this, stating that dukkha is derived from dusta, or in English, standing badly, and conveys nuances of unease, of being uncomfortable in one's position. This actually is a little bit better fit to the sense of sukha, which is its obvious opposite in the Rig Veda. Both of these place the emphasis on your entire sense of belonging in the world, your how well you feel at ease, how well you feel at navigating the whole of life, rather than just a pain in a specific moment. So to some extent, this is what the Buddha was aiming at, is that aspect of dukkha rather than just the pain of a specific moment. The second problem that I see in the way that of this shortened form of offering only four insights is that it omits some things that I think are really critically important to us as we start going down the Eightfold Path. Because it focuses too much on what is happening in the world or a definition of what's occurring. There actually are 12 insights that the Buddha put forth in these teachings. So rather than just being four insights, there are actually four sets of three insights. And they follow a pattern. The first insight of each of them, for example, the Four Noble Truths, the First Noble Truth, is a statement about the world or a statement about the self and your experience of the world. So in this case, he says there is suffering. If it actually stops at that, it's interesting, but it's not necessarily entirely useful. What he does beyond that, though, is he puts a second insight into that set of the First Noble Truth. And that is, he says, the dukkha should be understood. And doing this, the second insight then is giving you an idea of how you can react to what, why do you make that first insight? Why is that first insight important? In some sense, it's because there is a second insight, which is that you can do something with it that will help you move along the path and the goal in the direction that you're going. So in this case, dukkha exists, but our goal, our job then, is to fully understand dukkha. And, you know, there's a common sense meaning to that in the sense that if you're solving a problem or you're dealing with something and you don't know what that is that you're dealing with, or you don't know where you're going,
there's a good chance you're going to go veer off in a direction of your own invention, and you may not actually get where you're trying to go. So that's the reason that in all of these cases of teaching the Four Noble Truths, he added that second insight. Then the third insight that he has to all of them is what is called the fruit. The fruit is being what you're going to get out of it when you're done. And what he then says, the third truth of that's associated with the first noble, the third insight that's associated with the first noble truth is that dukkha is fully understood. And when you're fully understood, then you're in a position to gain wisdom from it. In the story of the Buddha's awakening, the demon Mara came to the Buddha in the early hours of the morning and said something like, "Who do you think you are? How could you even dare to think that you can become an enlightened being?" The Buddha's response was to say, "I see you, Mara. I know who you are, and I know what you're doing." The earth goddess then in the story affirms that, and Mara's vanished, disappears. In that same sense, knowing what dukkha is, to some extent, gives us that power to banish dukkha. Because we have to get to the point that we too will recognize when dukkha is starting to arise in our life, be able to see what its impact is on us, what effects it's having, how it's altering our mind states. When that happens, when you can clearly see the arising of dukkha, then you too can say, "I see you, dukkha. I know who you are." And in that instant, you have the power to banish it. And that is the reason that there is possibility for the ending of dukkha. Similarly, in the second noble truth, the Buddha goes beyond simply noting that dukkha is part of the conditioned world, and as part of the conditioned world, can be brought to an end. This is basically, as an aside, this is basically his teaching on dependent originations and conditioned arising. All conditioned things have a cause. They come into existence when the causes for it come into existence, and they disappear when the causes that support it disappear. He, as Susan has pointed out, he explored the nature of that cause, and he came down to the conclusion that it was a mind state or feeling that we experience called tanha. Now, tanha, like dukkha, has no specific translation into English, and it can cover a range of things such as craving, such as desire, such as aversion is a form of tanha. These are the emotions that can push us around without us wanting to, because we don't know them, we don't pay attention to them. So just like knowing dukkha, we have to know tanha. We have to see it arising. We have to be able to name it. We have to be able to recognize what it does to us and how it does those things. And in doing that, by being able to name it, we have also the ability to banish it. And because tanha is the cause of dukkha, if we banish tanha, if we banish those things pushing us around, it's not the experience of being angry. It's not the experience of desiring something that's the problem. It's the fact that we're being pushed around by them without recognizing them and being able to name them and being able to banish them if we choose to. But when we can do that, then dukkha itself has to disappear, because dukkha is conditioned on tanha. Similarly, then, with the third noble truth, the Buddha goes beyond and the indication there is that through this process of learning your mind, of learning to see these things arising in your world, in yourself, in everything that's happening, you can, in fact, come to this state where dukkha can be brought to an end. It's not a permanent thing. It's not something that you're stuck with. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't going to be things out in the world that will cause pain. And none of the Buddha's teachings say that that's not true. I mean, he alludes to the heavenly messengers of old age, illness, and death. He doesn't say you can avoid him. He doesn't say that he could avoid his own ending of illness that was probably caused by some type of food poisoning that led to the end of his life. There are other monastics, Angulimala, who was a murderer, who the Buddha converted to liberation. One day when, after he had been living with the Buddha, went into a village where he was recognized, the villagers stoned him, beat him. He came back in a really poor condition, and all the Buddha could say, this was your karma that you created, that you couldn't escape it. Yeah, you're going to have to suffer through it. But this was a liberated Arhat. So it's not that you're going to eliminate any pain in the world, but suffering is the dukkha, the suffering that he's alluding to in most cases, is not something that is out there, as Susan noted. It's something we do to ourselves. In Buddhism, there's often this allusion to a second arrow, where we have the pain, and then we turn around and stab ourselves. You know, it shouldn't be this way. This is not fair. All of these other things come up in our minds. This is where the suffering of dukkha comes into our lives. This is what torments us. Not necessarily the fact that, yes, it hurts if you hit your finger with a hammer, and but it's going to go away, you know. And so this is what the Buddha was trying to point to. And then on the fourth noble truth, the Buddha said that vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose with me regard to the things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha. This is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha is to be developed. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha has been developed. So those are the three insights. That there is a path, that you need to develop that path, and if you follow that path, it will lead to the cessation of dukkha. Now, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the way of the leading to the cessation of suffering is this eightfold path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So then what he does, what the fourth noble truth is gets into the specifics. How do you develop those elements, such as concentration, such as control of speech, such as your intentions in the world? How do you do those so that you can walk this path and bring about this the process of cessation? And as such, it is not about knowledge. It's more about experience. It's more about learning to look within, to see when these things are arising in the mind, to know them, to name them. And so that's what this program is really about. It's not teaching you the knowledge of doctrine and all of that. It's going to focus much more on learning to see, learning to have a little bit of space between yourself and being able to put a little space between you and the things that are happening in the world so that you can see, so that you know what the effects are and how they're arising and why they're arising, and being able to name dukkha, being able to rename craving, being able to name anger before it gets loose in the world and is not under your control. So that's kind of the preliminary table path. Okay, so what's next on the agenda? I think there's a breakout session. So I think we're going to do some breakout sessions. We'll put the people online in there in a couple of breakout groups. And let the people here, maybe in groups of three or four, whatever works for you, just, you know, use wisdom. The incidents of COVID in the county are on the rise. And so I want you to be healthy and stay through this whole program. I mean, we've all lived with it, and it's important to respect the risks as well as take care of ourselves. So I have a couple of things that sort of arise out of what I just said, and I'll put them in the chat in just a second. But What I'd like you to discuss when you're in the group is how what I've been saying or what we've been saying today fits with your understanding of the Four Noble Truths and how you brought them there, and why it is might be a central part of your practice, and how you think it might affect your practice over the next year. What would your intentions be? That clear to everybody? Okay, I will go ahead. You can go ahead and disperse, and I will put that into chat, I think, here, and I'll let you choose whoever you want to be with, and we'll do this for about 25 minutes. Give everybody a chance to speak. So welcome back. Hopefully we'll get our online people back as well, because I need to apologize for them. There was a sitting in Zoom that I didn't know was set that prematurely took them out after a certain number of minutes. In the future, I will endeavor to do a better job of handling my end of it and see if you don't get kicked out again.
Thank you.
Okay. I do apologize. I just didn't know it was set that way. This is not my computer. It's one the teachers use here, and I didn't do due diligence on checking all the hidden options. So anyway, so now that we're back, what we would like to do is bring some of this back to the room. So if there are people here that have any comments about the experience of doing that besides getting kicked out, I would love to hear them. Either online or in the room, just raise your hand and we'll bring you into the conversation. Paula?
Yes, sorry. I loved having the breakout group. I thought that was a wonderful idea. And I did have a lot to say, and I took up most of the time. And I wish that I had had been more time, because I really did kind of babble on. I wasn't babbling, but anyway, and then when I noticed we could have had more time, but it wouldn't let that bothered me. So anyway, thank you for looking into that and being, you know, I know you didn't know and you didn't do that on purpose. So right. Anyway, I'm sorry. I apologize publicly to my group members, because they didn't really get to talk at all, but they were great listeners, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And you'll have a second chance to set later in the program, and we'll make sure that you get a full length
awesome
breakout groups in okay. The second part of the program.
Thank you. It's mm-hmm. really great so far. I love it. I just want thank to you. Add that to you, and I thank you for doing it.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else in the room or elsewhere? We're just you went into the breakout group. Your experiences with it. Was it worthwhile? Did you learn anything? I'm not necessarily looking for anything profound. I'm just, you know, building community and knowing how people are reacting.
The microphone.
Yeah. If you use the microphone, they can hear you online. So let me give it to you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Our group was pretty nice mix of people who were bamboo and people who have been studying for years. And I think the others would agree with me, but I can only speak from my experience that it didn't matter. Everybody was just so connected with these ideas. And if you were brand new or had been studying for years, we all just were on an even plane. And it was quite a wonderful experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it reminds me of a quote that I heard from Thich Nhat Hanh when he was asked about Sangha. He said that, not to worry about it in this type of thing, that the person who's been here 1 week is going to help the person who's been here 1 day, and the person who's been here for a year will help the person who's been here for only 1 week. And this is how it works, and we'll get by doing it this way. So that was Thich Nhat Hanh's philosophy too. So anyone else? Okay, well, I think we're coming.
I can say it loudly. We talked a little bit about how people have been wanting community. It's just so nice to be able to sit and talk and get to know each other. And it's been a while since, we've been able to get together in groups like this here.
I'll echo that 100%. It's nice to get you back in person.
Good. Yes, it is for us as well. We've missed this community. Like I say, I've taught it before, and every year I learn a lot of things from my own practice, even though I've been practicing a long time, and it all comes from you. I mean, that's why I come back and do this program over and over, is the community that it creates, the development it helps me to achieve. They're not matched with most other programs I've been in. So thank you.
Yeah, Sangha is everything. Yeah. And these times, boy, after coming out of so much isolation, it's so good to connect with fellow practitioners. I'm so happy that you're here, that you're here online. It's really, I guess we really know the value of this now. 3 years of COVID.
Anyone else have anything to add, either online or in the room? If not, I think we'll go ahead and take a break so you can stretch your legs or whatever, and I guess we'll come back about 10 minutes and resume at that time. Thank you.
2:25.
Okay, great. So, welcome back.
It's really hard for us.
We're going to try and focus a little bit more on
the
second part of the day, on the program itself, some of the things you can expect, how to work with it. And then once we do that, you'll start. I hope I have everybody's email, at least, if you didn't register, because I will make arrangements for you to start receiving a weekly email that talks about things that you can work on between times. And we'll also, for those who want mentors, trying to set those up. But I will turn this over to Susan now to explore this topic more thoroughly.
Okay, wonderful. So as far as the program goes, I know some of you have been in the program before, and so every week there will be a list of reflections for you and ways to practice with that particular step of the path. And again, we hope that you'll be here for as much as or all of the program as possible, because they really, one step leads to another, and it's really kind of a circular path, really. And you will each be offered a mentor who can meet with you once a month, where you can ask questions and just share things from your practice. Does anyone have any questions about the kind of the unfolding of this? We'll be meeting here the second Sunday of the month to discuss, each step on the path. So as far as the logistics go, do you have any questions? I think you will truly appreciate the reflections and the exercises that are sent out every week. They're really, really helpful in terms of the, maintaining a consistency of your practice maintaining this kind of sense of you're on a path.
I think Tara, do you have a question?
Yeah.
She can't see you. I can, and that's why I came in and introduced. She wasn't ignoring you. It's just from her vantage point, she has no image of you.
Hi, Tara. Sorry.
Hi. So I just had a question. I know that Redwood City IMC is hosting their own Eightfold Path program parallel to this one. And I just was wondering, I believe that they have a day-long in-person summation of their program on June 22nd. And I'm wondering if we could attend that once we've also finished.
Yes, of course. It will be actually right near here at the Retreat Center in Scotts Valley, which is just across the border, borderline between Santa Cruz and Scotts Valley. So yes, probably Jim, at least Jim will be there, maybe. I will be there.
Yeah, traditionally we've merged this group, and then there's some other groups in the Central Valley that also have a similar program. I actually came out of IMC. I was trained by Gil and Andrea Fella for this program, so that was my roots as well. And every year we do a combined retreat at the Insight Retreat Center. So it'll be the same day, same time, and it will be the teachers from here, some of the mentors from here, and the teachers from IMC and their mentors as well. And it uses the meditation. It's a beautiful, if you haven't been to IRC, it's a beautiful location, and you're all certainly welcome to come. It's part of the program to do that.
Thank you.
Anyone else have a question about mechanics or whatever? And of course, it will unfold as we go forward, and there'll be plenty of communication. And okay, so, oh yes.
So the structure is every once a month, meet here or online. And then there's a mentoring that occurs as well, and then the exercises. So exercise is pretty straightforward, but on mentoring, how does that work?
The mentoring, how does the mentoring work?
Yeah.
Yes, well, you'll receive the name of a mentor, and the mentor will receive your name, and then we'll work with you to set up a time, maybe, and it could be that there'll be a group, a small group, or it could be one-on-one. You'll be connected with your mentor, and then you can work with the mentor to find a date that works for you. And then you can bring, you know, as we do this practice, you know, things come up and challenges. It's a challenging practice from time to time, so it's nice to have someone to meet with on a very personal basis and have some guidance.
Yeah, and typically it depends on you and your mentor. I've done one-on-one in person. I've done here in the library. I've done them at some of the parks. Or with a number of other people, particularly during recent years, they've been online, so I've been able to mentor people in other parts of the world and that type of thing. The goal is, what happens is with the Sunday program, we're going to introduce the element, right speech or right livelihood or right concentration, whatever it is, that topic. And then you'll start getting those on Monday. You'll normally get an email that has a number of different things that you can work with as to that particular topic. And as I said in my talk, there are 84,000 different paths, so we know that no two of you are going to go through this program exactly the same way. You're not going to choose to work on exactly the same elements of those things that come out on a weekly basis. But there'll be sort of that core topic in those weekly things. One month it may be one week it may be more focused on the Dharma doctrine or the way it was taught by the Buddha. Another may be work looking at how it comes up in your life at work and with your other people who are important to you and so forth. Then the idea of the mentor is at the end of the month, just before you go to the next element, you have a chance to meet with someone who is going through this program with you, And you can either bring up specific questions that have arisen during that month from the things you've been doing, questions you may have about the specific Buddhist teachings because something's not clear, or, you know, I generally don't try and focus the people I mentor into specific things, so sometimes we also go afield if they need to do that. We're not therapists, we're much, you know, focused on the Eightfold Path, but there's, in doing practice, doing meditation, sometimes, even though we might be talking the right speech, somebody needs some advice about concentration. I'll be happy to do that type of thing as a mentor. And so, like I say, the whole idea of what we were trying to do is to help you deepen your practice. We're not trying to teach you the doctrine. We're not trying to teach you suttas and all that. We're trying to help you find your own place in this practice and how these elements can help you on your own path towards liberation.
Okay, so I'll talk a little bit more about the Four Noble Truths, and then I have a story that I wanted to share. But this is the cornerstone, as we've talked about, the Four Noble Truths, the cornerstone of the Buddha's teachings. And it's really kind of, we're looking at life through the lens of the Four Noble Truths. I mean, people have different ways that they look, different views, different ways of looking at life, right? Some people are always looking for an opportunity to succeed, or an opportunity to get ahead, or an opportunity to make some money. You know, it's kind of like, what lens? This is a good question to ask for yourself. What lens do you use when you look at life? So for the Buddha, it was looking through the lens of these Four Noble Truths. The Buddha never concerned himself with the kind of metaphysical questions, you know, how did we get here, and what is the nature of the universe, and so on. He didn't really go there. He went to a very practical approach to life, to get through life, and with a not so much difficulty and suffering. And so this practice that we do, that he gifted to us, it doesn't tell us what's true. It doesn't tell us what we should believe in. It's just a way. It's a way of looking at life through this lens. And he gave us the tools to explore and discover for ourselves what is true for each one of us. What is true? What is it that we are in our deepest heart and mind? And this practice really is an invitation to get. When we get very quiet, we are able to look very deeply inside. Look at our intentions, look at our hearts, what's important to us, what's really important. And so it's an ennobling practice, and a practice that allows us, encourages us to be fully present for our bodies. Our bodies have a certain wisdom when we can tune in. Fully present for our mind and the thoughts that we that run over and over, you know, that tells us something about ourselves and our emotions, our feelings, and we're just as we did in the meditation, observing our experience just as it is. And you know, when there is suffering or stress, or dis-ease, however you want to think of it, the First Noble Truth simply recognizes that this is part of being human. And with this practice, what makes it kind of radical is that we turn towards the suffering rather than trying to push it away, run away from it, the usual way that people react when they're suffering. We bring the tools of investigation that the Buddha gave to us, the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of our thoughts and so on. And this is the way that we come to understand our suffering. And we look at what we harden to and resist. We look at what we try to grasp and hold on to. The demands that we make on ourselves and others. The drivenness. Our cultures kind of thrives on drivenness. The conflicts that we have with how things really are. And, you know, these are the forces within the mind that cause us to suffer. And, you know, the second noble truth, clinging, craving, wanting things to be other than what they are. And the third noble truth, you know, that this is the good news, you know, that through this practice of deep and inner investigation, it's possible for each one of us to be free of greediness and the defilements, hatred, delusion. And so this is what makes it a noble path, an ennobling path, the transformative practice. We can live with a greater sense of ease. And, of course, the fourth noble truth, the noble eightfold path that we will all walk together over the next year, that really is the path to this inner state of being, an inner state of freedom that doesn't depend on having things out there just the way we want them. So I thought I would just review the actions that are associated with each of the truths, the four noble truths. The first noble truth asks us to understand the truth of suffering, as I've just talked about, that in addition to, you know, sometimes Buddhists take the rap that all we talk about is suffering. Well, we talk about it so we can be free, and we also talk a lot about joy and beauty and true happiness. So, understanding that suffering happens, and then as Jim mentioned, making that distinction between the pain in life, the pain, heartbreak happens. You know, we have loved ones who have difficulties, we get sick, we lose people that we love. You know, this is the pain of life that we can't escape. At least we have a practice that helps us to, supports us during those painful times. It helps us to be with the pain, because it really, this is what, it deepens us as human beings. But the suffering is what we add to the pain. The anger, the denial, the feeling that this shouldn't be so. And all that extra stuff, that's the suffering. And that's where we can practice to be free. And of course, the third noble truth is realizing the potential of this practice and the possibility of finding complete freedom in this very life, to be free from drivenness, cravings, resentments, and all of that. Those negative emotions. So realizing and then following the Eightfold Path. So I thought that what I would share with you would be have a few minutes to share a story. Some of you might know this story. The life of the Buddha. And the Buddha was born Siddhartha Gautama. He was the son of a nobleman in northern India in about 500 BC. And he grew up in luxurious surroundings in a palace with servants all around. who took care of his every need and desire. And Siddhartha's father was actually a warrior king, or a warrior within his kingdom. And there was a lot of discord in the Indian continent at that time. Different kingdoms vying for more, take over another kingdom. And this particular kingdom where the Buddha lived, where Siddhartha lived, was rising in power amongst the surrounding kingdoms. And Siddhartha's father had great hopes for his son to be a powerful ruler to take over for him. So, but interestingly enough, at the birth of Siddhartha, there was a soothsayer who was present, and the soothsayer made a prophecy that that Siddhartha would be presented with four signs representing the miseries of the world, and these signs would convince Siddhartha to follow the path of a teacher and not the path of a great ruler, as his father so wished. And so the father schemed and thought that he would make sure that Siddhartha was surrounded by only youth and beauty and pleasure. An interesting strategy. However, when Siddhartha was not enjoying himself with the luxuries in the palace, he would pass his time out riding and hunting on the beautiful palace grounds. Well, one day he was riding, and beside him was his charioteer, Achana. And suddenly they saw a kind of a gnarled ancient person, a man, appeared, having somehow wandered onto the palace grounds. And Siddhartha had never seen anything like this before. He said, "What, Chana, what is this creature?" "Oh, that's just an aging person. This is how it is, how it will be for all of us in this life if we live long enough," he said. Another time when Siddhartha was out riding, he noticed a man covered with sores and shaking from fever. "What is happening to this person, Chana?" he asked. "That's a sick person, my lord. We all will suffer from illness from time to time." And a third time, yet another time, when Siddhartha had convinced Chana to take him, to the town so that he could see more of life outside the palace. I'm sure his father was unaware of this. And this time, Siddhartha saw there was a corpse laid out in the square. And he said, "Chana, what is this?" "Oh, that's a dead person, my lord. We will all end up like that." So, of course, this was shaking Siddhartha. He was quite disturbed, disheartened by what he had seen. And the palace, with all its pleasures, seemed now to him not worth very much if this was what was in store for him: aging, sickness, and death. But there was a fourth occasion when Siddhartha was out and about, and he saw a simple monk in a yellow robe, and the monk carried an alms bowl and looked so peaceful and contented that Siddhartha was like, "That's the path. That's the path for me. That's what I want to follow." So, much to the sorrow and disappointment of his father, Siddhartha left the palace, and he began his search, and he began to, with the ascetics, there were quite a few sects of asceticism in India at the time, and so he lived as an ascetic for 6 years, often it said subsisting on a single grain of rice a day. But and it's said that he was so emaciated that his navel touched his spine. But this extreme way of living brought Siddhartha no peace, and he began to eat and care for himself again and to continue his seeking. And when he was 36, he sat himself down under the Bodhi tree, and he vowed that he was not going to get up until he had found a way to end the suffering of being human. So for 7 weeks, it's said, he sat absorbed in meditation, looking deeply into the workings of his own mind, looking deeply into the interplay between body and mind, looking deeply into his perceptions of what lay outside of himself. And in the end, he became the Buddha, Buddha meaning the enlightened one. And he framed his teachings as the middle way. So the path that he laid out, the path to wisdom, not one of denial and asceticism on the one hand, as he experienced himself directly, and it is not one of self-indulgence, as he himself experienced directly as a young prince living in the palace. So when we sit, we are really using the Buddhist technique that he used for enlightenment, of looking deeply inside. That's the tradition of Buddhism that we practice here, insight meditation, or vipassana being the Pali word for looking very deeply inside. And so why do we do this? To find some freedom and a happiness that does not rely on the conditions outside of ourselves. So that's what I brought to share with you today. And so now let's break out again into our discussion sessions. And I have a couple of questions, topics for you, for your group. So the first one is, you know, what are some of the lenses that you have used in the past to look at your life, or that you've observed others using? But mainly, what lens have you been using or are you using now? And which of those lenses in your life were beneficial, and which lenses may have led to some suffering? So that's the topic. So you can go into your groups, and I'll just come by again and just repeat those. It can be helpful. And so then we'll come back in about 15 minutes.
And I'll move the Zoom people into their groups, and I think I've got it, so you won't come back early this time. Thank you.
Can everyone hear me all right? Everyone?
Yeah.
Everyone online can hear me? Okay. Well, this is the time when we open it to, you know, any questions or comments, you know, based on your group experience or any of the things that we have covered today. We're happy to hear from you. If you have a question or something that was particularly touched you, or anything that you would like to share. Yes, and tell me your name again.
Adriana.
Andriana.
First, I just want to say it feels so good to be in person. Happy to see the Zoom people too, but
probably should have this.
Okay.
Can people online hear her?
Can you guys hear me?
No.
I don't think they can. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Sure.
I'm Adriana, and I just wanted to say, first off, it feels so, so good to be back in person. And I'm happy to see the Zoom people here, too, and that there's, you know, space for all of us. It just feels really juicy and alive to be in person. And as far as the question about the lens, we all, had a lot of great things come up. And one thing that someone else in the group brought up is sometimes she feels like sometimes it's not even her lens she's looking through, it's someone else's, like our mother's or whoever's. And that we all really echo that, that can happen a lot, that through the practice, it feels like we are able to uncover who we really are without putting ourselves in that box, but to somehow make our own lens clear about how we feel versus all those other factors and other people's lens around us. So that was one thing that really came up for us.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, our own truths come very clear to us as we get very quiet with this practice, right? Our own truth.
Can the audience folks please speak a little louder? I could barely hear, and I can't turn my computer up somehow.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
Bringing that up. I'll try to speak up. Can you hear me okay?
Better. Thank you.
Okay. And your name again?
My name is Sydney from Australia, or you might recall. And through this discussion, it just became so clear to me how powerful that is. Whatever lens we're looking through, if we're not aware of it especially, it changes everything. It could. But how do people even become aware of it? I mean, those of us here, of course, now start becoming aware of it, but how does anybody really become aware that they're looking at the world through a lens that isn't theirs? This is... I don't know if you're going to be speaking more about that, but that's, I'm feeling really curious about that.
Yeah, it's only when we get really quiet and really look deeply inside that we begin to see these various ways that aren't ours of viewing things. So,
may I say something about that?
Please.
It just strikes me that that the lady from Australia, I forgot her name, what she was just
Sydney.
Of course, Sydney. Nah. from what she was saying, how we're not aware necessarily of lenses that we're looking through, and it, all of a sudden it hit me thinking about the big disparity in our country right now of the politics, you know, if there's so many people that think one way and so many that think another. And I wonder how much of that is related to the, you know, lens that they are, that's being used. Maybe there's two different lenses. I mean, I'm not sure, but I wonder if that's part of the problem of all of, wars even, and, you know, everybody disagreeing. I don't know. Maybe I'm talking in really general terms here, but I just thought that. So that's all I wanted to say for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula.
Yeah, and what I'll add is, you're right. The Buddhist term for that was delusion. I mean, that's what delusion is, when you are looking out and what you're seeing is the reflection of your own mind rather than what's taking place in the world. And that's why so much of this practice is about coming to realize what's happening in the real world, what's really taking place around you.
Yes.
And will we address that? Yeah, that's one of the main points. I mean, that's
beautiful.
One of the points of mindfulness. That's one of the main points of learning to control one's attention. That's at the deep root of our practice.
Great. Thank you.
We call it clear seeing. People live inside a box in their mind, and they don't look outside the box. That's it for them. It's very difficult to even get them to consider a different view. It's quite frightening, actually. I think that's what happened in Nazi Germany, right? They didn't come out of their box. Anyway, anyone else?
I'm also kind of struggling with this idea of linearity, like the path, like it's a progression that from A to B, like A or A to Z or whatever. And I think the time, because time seems to run like that too, but the whole path actually I think is rather recursive, and it's so hard to change your mind because into a recursive viewpoint rather than a, well, I'll get there, or you have to do A, B, and C and, you know, I'll achieve nirvana, or, you know, it's always like these steps and this, but actually I think it's much more recursive. Life is, and the path is, and so on. So it's more like a circle.
Yes, exactly, Melissa. Yeah, it's circular. One step influences another, and not so much in a linear fashion, you know. So, thank you for bringing that up. It's presented in kind of a linear fashion, but it's really more circular, and one step influences the others often. Yeah, so that's a much better way of thinking of it. Yeah, thank you.
And what I think I'll add to that a little bit is that in the Buddhist teachings, it's not about achieving any particular one of these things, but rather arriving at the right balance between all of them. And so what typically happens in people's practice is there will be a period of time when someone is deep into meditation, and then they burn out on that. And then they go deep into service. And so what you get is it's more like a spiral going round and round, taking you deeper and deeper as you continue that flow. But it's about balance. And that's why you have to move around to the various places, and that's why it seems to keep coming back on you. Anyone else? Anyone else have a comment or a question?
Anyone online? Are you all good online there? Okay.
You might want to mute that one. There's series of things.
No. There we go. Do you just want to do a short meditation? Or?
Oh, I thought it was
cold. No, I'm just asking, do you move to that, or do you have more you want to do?
No. Why don't we sit together?
Okay, why don't we sit for a couple of minutes because of the content today? I'll run it as a little bit of practice at the same time. And the challenge that I want to give you is really a very simple one. It's about being aware. You know, we when we practice meditation and get into concentration and all sorts of other things that are in the Buddhist path, it always seems daunting, you know, to learn to enter the jhanas, all sorts of things that are great skills and stuff. But in Vipassana meditation, really the most important thing that you will learn to do is to monitor and control your own attention. And attention takes nothing. I mean, right now, are you aware? Can you pay attention to this moment? What does it feel like? Did it take some type of special skill or whatever to say, oh, I'm awake, I'm here. Now you'll drift. And that happens. But coming back to the present moment, the question was asked earlier, how do you start seeing these lenses? How do you start doing that? It's that ability to come back to the present moment, being aware of what's in the present moment. And as you strengthen it, there will be a certain part of the mind, certain part of the self, that is can stay in that awareness of the present moment, even in the midst of turmoil and busyness and everything else. It's called mindfulness, and that's one of the skills that is critical to this path. So we're just going to sit for a minute, and I'll probably interrupt occasionally to simply ask you if you're aware. So, maybe 10 minutes here, something like that. Are you aware? What does it feel like to be aware? Does it feel different than the moment before you, my voice, interrupted your meditation? Bert said, to spend a little time practicing awareness. Well, we're coming towards the end, and like I say, thank you for coming. I think the date of the next one is October 8th, and we should be, if anybody hasn't submitted their email to us or registered online, we'd like you to do that, and I will. You'll start getting the emails shortly. And the next couple of weeks, I'll be talking to various teachers and arranging for those of you who have asked for mentors to make the connection so that you can meet, hopefully towards the end of the month before. Actually, you don't meet this month because there wasn't a topic. You'll meet at the end of October. This is the first time because we'll introduce the topic at October 8th. Then you'll have time to work with it. Then you meet with your mentor towards the end before the meeting. So there's some time in here. But those who have asked for mentors expect to hear from me through email to set that up or from your mentor. And for those who have decided that they can't make the commit to it, I'm open to possibly arranging some one-time interviews or one-time sittings for questions and answers as we go through this eight-month period. So think about it if that form would be useful to you, and if it would, we'll set some type of program together to schedule those or ask for that type of thing. So that's about it for me. Do you?
I have a little story to share before we leave. It's called Heaven or Hell, Your Choice. A big, burly samurai comes to a Zen master and says, "Tell me the nature of heaven and hell." The Zen master looks him in the face and says, "Why should I tell a scruffy, disgusting, miserable slob like you? A worm like you, do you think I should tell you anything?" Consumed by rage, the samurai draws his sword and raises it to cut off the master's head. The Zen master says, "That's hell." Instantly, the samurai understands he has created his own hell, black, hot, filled with hatred, self-protection, anger, resentment. He sees he was so deep in hell that he was ready to kill someone. Tears fill his eyes as he puts his palms together to bow in gratitude for this insight. The Zen master says, "That's heaven." So, anyway, pleasure to practice with you all today. Stay well.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if there's any literature that you would recommend reading concurrently with this program.
There are a couple of books that would that are useful, and then there are a number of writings by Gill. I think some of those should have been sent to you by email from if you registered, but if not, I can see if we can get them to you. Yeah,
I just registered earlier, so I don't know if I haven't gotten any other email about that. So maybe I'll look out for one.
Okay, if you've registered, I'll have your email, so I will check into it as well and make sure that you get the material you need. But if you don't get it, just email us at theeightfoldpath@insightsantacruz.org and we'll get the mail from you.
Can you send it to all of us? Because I didn't get it either.
Yeah. I'll check. Usually it's an automated part of the process of registering, but I will make sure that everybody's getting it. Yeah. Now that I have it, that's why I need this email list of everybody that's in the program, just to make sure this stuff goes out.
I highly recommend Bhante Gunaratana's book, The 8 Steps to Happiness. Excellent.
Is that in the email list?
I believe it is.
Okay. I haven't looked it over carefully, but that's great.
Bhante Gunaratana.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yes.
Yeah. It'd be nice if that's on the list.
Yeah.
The Eightfold Path to Happiness. If you look it up online, you'll see it.
I just wanted to quickly thank Jim. I think Jim was the tech guy for today, and I've done a lot of Zoom in the last 3 years, and normally there's always a separate person handling tech, never the person running the format doing the tech at the same time. I don't know how you managed that, but thank you. I think you did a beautiful job, and you learned something from it, all the better. But I really bow to you. That is not easy to do. And you made it very graceful. I appreciate it a lot because it let me join in. And I'm so grateful I could do that today.
Thank you. I'm glad you were here as well.
Oh, gratitude, Jim. Yes.
Okay. Anyone else? If not, we'll adjourn and meet again in October, and we'll be in contact in the meantime. If you have questions in the program, like I say, Eightfold Path at InsightSantaCruz.org, it'll get to us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.